I'm here with Alexander Mercuris, editor-in-chief of The Drian. Alexander, let's talk about the Russia-China gas pipeline that is now in operation. And I'm going to read you a pretty large piece of a CNN article, Alexander, which announces the gas pipeline, which has now been switched on. CNN calls it the mega pipeline to China from Russia. I'm going to read you a pretty large excerpt. But before I read you that excerpt, I want you to just comment a little bit as to why I chose CNN. So I can read, I could choose a lot of different outlets, but I chose CNN. And my thinking there, you can comment on it, and then we'll get to what they say. My thinking is, after all these years, from even beyond, even before the Ukraine coup and the Obama years, they've demonized Russia, they've sanctioned Russia, they've demonized its people, they've demonized its president, they've backed Russia into a corner. Russia, to a certain extent, even though you've said they're a natural fit, Russia and China, but to a certain extent, all these moves have accelerated Russia's push towards China. They've deepened this relationship between China and Russia. This was a massive, massive strategic, geopolitical, strategic blunder. I think it'll go down in history as Obama's biggest mistake was the policies that he enacted to destroy and demonize Russia, which have amounted to nothing. The EU as well has also followed in Obama's footsteps. And I chose CNN, Alexander, because CNN, the New York Times, MSNBC, the Daily Beast, Newsweek, all these mainstream media outlets joined in and they demonized Russia as well, all the way up to Russiagate. And they're complicit in what is now what I consider a very powerful alliance between Russia and China. And on that note, before you comment on what I've said, one mainstream media host, one mainstream media personality, Tucker Carlson, is actually speaking about this, saying openly on Fox News that we should, the United States, we should embrace a closer relationship with Russia. Why the hell did we get involved in this whole Ukraine mess? Tucker is actually saying this. He's actually saying, I would choose Russia over Ukraine because he realizes that this alliance between Russia and China is formidable, it's powerful, and it is going to come back to bite the United States in the ass. So Alexander, before I get to the CNN, what they said, comment on my open.
Well, can I say that he's all absolutely right. And in terms of the demonization of Russia, CNN has played a terrible role. Not just CNN, as you say, all of the mass media across the United States and the West has been heavily implicated in this. But for me, the single thing that the particular anger I have towards CNN is that more than any other TV channel, I mean, Washington Post and the New York Times played it, and the Guardian, by the way, played a huge role, but CNN played the absolutely key role during Russiagate of trying to undermine the president of the United States, Donald Trump, who had some awareness of the danger of this alliance between Russia and China that was starting to emerge and had a particular policy or desire or wish to try to improve relations with Russia so as to draw it away from China. CNN was absolutely at the forefront of the claims that Donald Trump, but because he was talking about these things, was some kind of Russian agent, was the Siberian candidate planted by the Kremlin, and was at the center of all the collusion conspiracies. And of course, CNN, more than any other media outlet, was the one that was propagating all those leaks from the intelligence agencies and which has got into bed, frankly, with all these people in the intelligence agencies, many of them now work for CNN as hosts, and which was spreading all the nonsense that they were saying. So for CNN now to turn around and wake up to the fact that these things, which to his credit, Donald Trump had some understanding about and tried to resist and prevent that CNN, which more than any other news outlet, played a central role in preventing Donald Trump from pursuing that policy, that it should be the one to start now raising alarm bells about that situation, which played such a big role in creating, well, it's pretty rich, as we say in England. And of course, CNN was very much part of the Barack Obama fan club. And you're completely correct in saying Barack Obama, it was his administration when all the things with Russia started to go wrong. He tried to micromanage Russian domestic policies through the process known as the reset, which was not a rapprochement with the Russians. It was an attempt to control their domestic politics by playing off Dmitry Medvedev, who was at that time the president and was perceived wrongly to be more liberal, against Vladimir Putin, who was being demonized already as this hardline Russian nationalist, which, by the way, he wasn't, but that's another story. And it was Barack Obama who greenlighted this policy of trying to detach Ukraine from Russia, which was, you know, if you know anything about Ukraine and you know anything about Ukraine's relationship to Russia, was a crazy thing to do. I cannot think of anything that the US could have done which was going to be more calculated to anger and upset the Russians than for them to get involved in Ukraine. And of course, on top of all of that, when you look at what's now happening and what Ukrainegate is revealing, it's contaminated American politics with this grotesque sewer of corruption, which is politics in Ukraine today. But, you know, focusing again on Russia, he also betrayed them as they feel. And this is very difficult to convey again to Western audiences because they've never really been exposed to this. On arms control, he got them to agree to massive reductions in strategic forces, in strategic nuclear forces, on the basis that George W. Bush's anti-ballistic missile programs would not proceed in the way that they were going to proceed in Eastern Europe. And it turned out that, in fact, they were proceeding, though in a somewhat different way. And of course, last but not least, I mean, he played an extraordinary role in orchestrating, you know, the whole business around the scandals of the Sochi Olympics, the demonization of Putin, all those things. And of course, ultimately, with Russiagate itself, it was under Barack Obama that all the stories about Donald Trump being the Siberian candidate started to circulate. And we had all those leaks and reports in the news media that I was talking about with CNN, in which they were going around talking about Donald Trump being a Russian agent and the collusion and all those sort of things. So Barack Obama played a central role in all of this. And CNN, I'm sorry to say, which is, of course, very much a Barack Obama a fan club, CNN has played a huge part in the media campaign that has ultimately led to this. And in later parts of our program, I'm going to talk about how the Russian-Chinese relationship is now developing.
All right, so the fruits of Obama's presidency is foreign policy and the fruits of CNN's misinformation. Straight from CNN, Alexander, the title of the article is Russia Switches on Gas Mega Pipeline to China as Putin Touts Closer Ties. Russia switched on an enormous gas pipeline to China worth billions of dollars Monday, affirming increasingly close economic and political ties between the two countries. Named the Power of Siberia, the pipeline runs more than 8,100 kilometers, 5,000 miles across the two countries, according to Chinese state-run news agency Xinhua, and will deliver 38 billion cubic meters of natural gas annually by 2024. It will be operated by Russia's state-owned company Gazprom. Chinese President Xi Jinping and Russian President Vladimir Putin watched via video link as the pipeline was inaugurated before congratulating each other on a historic moment, Quote, that step brings the Russian-Chinese strategic partnership in the energy sector to a whole new level, Putin said in a statement to news agency TASS. TASS said that deliveries had started flowing through the pipeline as of Monday, although the amount will start small and then ramp up over the years. Gazprom CEO Alexei Miller announced to both leaders that the pipeline had been opened via video link. Quote, gas is flowing to the gas transmission system of the People's Republic of China, he said. A 30-year deal was signed by Putin and Xi in 2014. And while a final figure has not been announced, it is believed to be worth more than $400 billion. According to analysts at S&P Global, Platts' total sales through the pipeline will represent nearly 10% of China's entire energy gas supply by 2022 and will help to solidify Beijing's energy security. China has been trying to move away from coal and towards alternative forms of power in the past few years as the country tackles a severe air pollution problem and growing concerns about its carbon emissions. In April, U.S. oil giant ExxonMobil announced a 20-year agreement to supply China with liquefied natural gas. Meanwhile, China is expected to overtake the European Union as early as 2021 as the world leader in use of solar panels. Multiple Chinese state media publications trumpeted on Tuesday that the country now had access to a greater amount of clean energy compared to previous heavy use of coal. According to Xinhua, natural gas expected to provide 50% of China's energy mix by 2030. And Alexander, the last part, Deep Friendship is the title. The agreement was struck shortly after European countries began to look at reducing their reliance on Russian gas following Moscow's annexation of parts of Ukraine in February 2014. Ties between Beijing and Moscow have grown increasingly close under Xi's leadership of China, with Putin saying in June that relations had reached an unprecedented level. This marks 70 years since diplomatic ties were established between Beijing and Moscow following the founding of the People's Republic of China in 1949. But relations between the two neighboring countries have often been tense, even when both were run by communist governments. Alexander, that's the basic summary, a large summary of the article.
Yeah.
What do you have to say?
Well, the first thing to say, and this is a personal thing, I was actually present when the decision to create the pipeline was announced. I was at the St. Petersburg International Economic Forum in, I think it was June 2014. And I remember Vladimir Putin turning up at the plenary session in the presence of a member of the Chinese Politburo and announcing that a decision to build this pipeline had been made. And we were all in the audience and we were all rather stunned because there was no prior warning that this was going to happen. And 2014 is, of course, a very significant year because it is the year of the Maidan coup in Ukraine. It came very shortly before the imposition by the West of sectoral sanctions on Russia, but already there was a growing crisis in relations between the West and Russia. And I remember that at this forum, which I attended in St. Petersburg, which is a big Russian economic forum, the Western businesses had largely absented themselves. They were all boycotting it. And who, of course, was there in force and in strength? But the Chinese, I mean, the Chinese saw the opportunity and they went for it. And here we have this pipeline. Now, the other thing I remember from 2014, and it went on for some years after that, is there were all kinds of confident predictions by all sorts of people, both in the West and in Russia, by the way, various liberal people in Russia, anti-Putin people in Russia, that this pipeline would never be built. It made no economic sense, supposedly. It was going to be very difficult to build it over this huge distance. The geological and geographical problems were allegedly insuperable. The Russian economy was supposedly in crisis and could never complete it. And I can remember this extraordinary wishful thinking going on for years, actually, afterwards, saying that this is all a fantasy, that Putin had simply announced this thing because he wanted to, you know, give himself some useful headlines at the summit, and that it was not meant to be taken seriously. And here we are, it's built, And by the way, it's only it's the first of one of many. It's not going to be the only pipeline. There are going to be other pipelines. There's already other pipelines under construction in Russia, linking Russia with, in terms of natural gas and in terms of oil, to China. We're going to see lots more of these. And of course, since 2014, this rather nebulous Silk Road, as it was then called, that the Chinese were talking about, has evolved into the far more ambitious and far more important Belt and Road Initiative, which, to be very clear, is basically about integrating Eurasia, China, Russia, other Eurasian countries, into a gigantic single economic system underpinned by pipelines like this. Now, I wanted to say a few things about the Chinese energy situation, because when it all began, I mean, this is when, you know, the United States began to become increasingly antagonistic to China, which incidentally also started under the Barack Obama administration. It was Obama who began the so-called pivot to the East, which is all about containing China. I can remember at that time there were all these discussions in the fringe sections of the US mainstream media, these geopolitical magazines which, you know, proliferate in the United States, and which are built by all these, you know, published by all these think tanks, all these American think tanks, which, you know, exist to an extraordinary quantity. And there was talk about the US Navy imposing a blockade on China and preventing China exporting its goods and first and foremost importing its oil and its gas. And this is going to be, you know, the major lever that the US was going to have over China. And of course, the Chinese, who have very long memories, are very familiar with their history. And they also remember how in the run-up to the Second World War, in the run-up to Pearl Harbor, and the Chinese have discussed this, by the way, this isn't, you know, something that, you know, is coming out of, you know, nowhere, but there's actually been Chinese discussions about this. The US imposed on Japan in 1941, an oil blockade. And it was that which provoked the Japanese, who had, let's be clear, I mean, you know, they had all kinds of other reasons, but it was one of the things that made them decide that they would launch a military attack, an absolutely disastrous and insane military attack upon the US. The Chinese are never going to let themselves be put in that position. So they're not going to rely on the US for liquefied natural gas. They do need to move away from coal, which has been the base of their energy mix up to now. It's very dirty. It creates huge problems in Chinese cities with air pollution. Natural gas is very, very much cleaner. And they've now got an absolutely secure source of natural gas from Russia, which is going to fulfill all their needs. Initially, it will be, what, 10% of their energy mix? It's going to grow. It's going to grow entirely. And as I said, when you're looking at a united economic complex, Eurasian economic complex, you understand what huge implications that has. Any ideas of imposing embargoes or sanctions upon China are simply going to become impossible, because with Russia at its back, China will become impervious to those kind of pressures. And coming back to your the point that you made at the start of this program, if we're looking at the Russians, yes, they wanted good relations with China. They weren't looking in the early 2000s for a strategic partnership, in effect, an alliance with China. And they would not have gone to all that trouble and all that expense of building all these pipelines to China if they could just have gone on selling their gas as they always would do, as they were already doing to Europe, because Europe was a secure, seemed to be a stable partner, and it was paying well. Why go to all that trouble if you can rely on your well-established and traditional customer to buy all your gas? So what the West has achieved is it's lost that monopoly position it had as the great customer of Russian gas. It has massively increased China's leverage and security of position and energy security. And it has bound China and Russia together in this emerging Eurasian economic complex. I mean, well done, Barack Obama. Well done, CNN. Well done, all the others who've, you know, been prattling on in this way. I mean, you've achieved extraordinary things.
Yeah, what a bunch of dummies.
What a bunch of dummies.
Well, they took the ideological route out. They got all ideological about it. They were hungry for power, hungry for money, and they let their whole ideology and all their craziness and the Trump derangement syndrome, and even before Trump came into the picture, the Sochi stuff, the Olympic stuff, all of those things, and they pushed a massive resource-rich country into an alliance with a massive economy and a huge population, a huge consumer base like China.
Yeah, I know. Absolutely. I mean, can I just say something about this? I mean, they also, I think, failed to learn the key lesson of the Cold War. One of the reasons the United States came through successfully in the Cold War was because the Chinese and the Russians had this massive falling out in the 60s. And by the way, can I just say something? It's a complete misconception that the Chinese and the Russians are normally have bad relations. If you look at the whole sweep of Russian-Chinese history, which really starts getting going in the 17th century, with the Treaty of Nerchisk, by the way, which was negotiated by Peter the Great's ministers. No, that's history now. If you look at the whole sweep of Russian-Chinese history, usually relations between the Russians and the Chinese, most of the time, have been pretty good. There have been ups and there have been downs, but overall, they got on with each other. This idea that there's this huge antagonism and hostility between these two countries is actually wrong. But in the 1960s, the Chinese and the Russians, who were at that time as ideologically obsessed as CNN and all these people today are in the West, at that time, they did have this massive falling out. And the United States, especially Kissinger and Nixon, understood the extent to which this was empowering the US. It meant that the US could play the Chinese and the Russians off against each other, extracting concessions both from the Chinese and the Russians by telling them that if they didn't get those concessions, they'd either side with the one or with the other. And in terms of the Russians, what the Russians had to do was, because their relations with China was so bad, they had to deploy these huge military forces to the Far East, which were the single thing which more than anything else crippled their defense budget, because they couldn't be equally strong both in the West and in the East to the extent that they needed to be in any way that was affordable. And by the way, I've heard Chinese people tell me the same thing, because they had to have these huge armies in northern China, that was making it much more difficult for China to find the resources for its economic takeoff. So the US benefited hugely from the Chinese-Russian falling out of the 60s. The very last thing the US should have done is put these two countries together when their aggregate resources, you talked about Russia's vast size and natural resources and its great scientific and technological skills, and it's some of its industries are also very advanced. And China's immense population and tremendous industrial and manufacturing resources. The last thing you want to do is to bring these two giants together. I mean, if you're the United States, you try and keep them apart. I mean, it's obvious. It should be obvious. But the US did the opposite. And it's not reversible now. And it's going to pay the price.
Yeah, that's my last question to you. It's game over. I mean, what I've seen in analyzing geopolitics is the minute you start putting gas pipelines, you know, in the ground and connecting countries, it's pretty much, those countries are pretty much, that's it. You're locked together. I mean, it's game over. It's so hard to decouple.
Yes.
Even if you get into a fight, it's so hard to move away from that country that has that gas pipeline, you know, sunk into your land.
Yeah.
And the case in point, I would guess, is something like Ukraine, where for all the effort of the United States to get Ukraine and the EU to get Ukraine away from Russia, I think it's those gas pipelines and that gas transit and the oil and all those natural resources that keeps Ukraine tethered to Russia. And for example, in TASS today, we have that Ukraine and Russia signed a 10-year oil transit agreement. That's news that broke today. And so I think Russia and China now, it's game over. Those two countries are now connected at the hip. That's it. And it's difficult. It's going to be so difficult to move China away from Russia and Russia away from China in the same way and in the same effect that it's almost impossible to get Ukraine away from Russia. It's just not going to happen because of the gas and the energy.
Exactly so. I mean, can I just say, I mean, you know, Ukraine has had a fervidly anti-Russian government. It's done absolutely everything it possibly can to try to sever these connections. And what happens, it finds that in the end, it can't do so. It's pulled, as you correctly say, inexorably back because it is inside, it is essentially part of this system. And can I just say, I mean, one of the problems that Ukraine has had, I mean, it looked to the EU to integrate economically with the EU. The vast investment from the EU, the investment in Ukrainian factories, the development of Ukraine's agriculture, the opening up of the EU to Ukrainian export markets that they were expecting never happened. Russia is still Ukraine's biggest trading partner. But of course, there's someone else now coming behind the Russians, the big guy with the deep pockets. It's China. China is now coming into this. It's actually now talking about buying, for example, Ukraine's gas turbine industry, its aircraft building industry, its engines industry. All these things that, you know, used to depend so heavily on the Russians. So if you think about China and Russia creating a kind of Eurasian complex together, well, Ukraine has been drawn back into it. It has to deal with the Russians on the energy side. That's why we've now had this extraordinarily important transit deal, by the way, on oil that a Transneft, which is the Russian state oil transportation company, is now going to be transporting oil over 10 years to Ukraine, all quietly negotiated without very much discussion. But this deal has now been done. Ukraine can't pull away from Russia, and it's been drawn back into the Eurasian system because, as I said, the Chinese are coming into Ukraine now in a big way. And apparently John Bolton, one of the very last things he did is he went to Ukraine and tried to tell the Ukrainians, don't make these deals with China. And the Ukrainians told him, sorry, we've got no choice. We've got to. We have no option because that's the kind of economic system that we are part of, and we can't grow our economy and provide our people with proper living standards unless we do these things. Now, you know, and that's Ukraine. China, unlike Ukraine, does not have a fervidly anti-Russian government. China has very friendly feelings towards Russia. So all these pipelines are being built. As I said, there's going to be many more of them. And there's going to be more and more linkages. I mean, already the Russians and the Chinese are working together very heavily in aerospace technology. The Russians are designing a wide-bodied aircraft. The Chinese are going to build it. The Russians are going to design and are building the very big aircraft engines that they're going to be using for this aircraft. The Russians and the Chinese are also working together on big scale helicopter development. The Russians are talking about the Chinese building high-speed railways in China, in Russia. I mean, it's becoming a partnership across the board. And why shouldn't it? These countries have no reason to quarrel with each other. They've sorted out all their border issues. Contrary to what some people say, even sometimes I've noticed on our threads, there's no threat to China, to Russia from China, and there's no threat to China from Russia. So these synergies, these linkages are going to grow on a huge scale, and they're not going to be reversed at all. And neither the Russians nor the Chinese have any incentive to reverse them. They are a done thing. People who want to pull these two countries apart, people like Macron, who've been talking about this, the train has left the station. You can run after it, but you can't catch up.
Finally, Alexander, very quickly, remember Hillary Clinton's Russia reset with Lavrov? What a joke that was.
Well, of course.
Boy, did they mess up. Boy, did the Obama administration mess
absolutely.
Up.
Absolutely. I mean, for those of our viewers who don't know this, I mean, she came along. This is just after Obama had been elected, and he appointed her Secretary of State. I mean, almost the last person you'd want to send to Russia to try and engineer a rapprochement with Russia was Hillary Clinton. Anyway, she turned up at this meeting with Lavrov, and she had this, sort of fake toy switch that she brought with the what she said was the Russian word reset, except of course it didn't say reset, it said overload or something crazy like that. I mean, as Lavrov, who of course can read Russian, he is after all the Russian foreign minister, pointed out to her. Now, of course, the point about that, I mean, it was absolutely ridiculous. But, you know, I do not believe the people in the State Department there aren't people there who speak Russian and can't put a thing like that together properly. I mean, it was already, in my opinion, a sign that there were lots of people in the US bureaucracy who just weren't taking the whole thing seriously and weren't really supporting it in any way. I mean, that it was never really intended to be a genuine rapprochement. Now, the Chinese never make those sort of mistakes. I mean, they come along to the Russians, and of course, they're very respectful to the Russians, even though, to be absolutely clear, they are the bigger power and they're the senior partner in this enterprise. But you will never see Xi Jinping or any Chinese official acting in this way. And the result is they won. They won the game.
Complete incompetence.
Complete incompetence.
White House and the Hillary Clinton State Department. Complete incompetence.
Complete incompetence, absolutely. Incompetence for which the American people, the United States, will pay a price. Because, as I said, it had an option. It had a position in 2008, where it could have had both China and Russia where it wanted them. They'd been friendly, you'd been able to play with them and work with them, because they both at that time, I mean, for both the Chinese and the Russians, the important country they wanted to be friends with was the US. Not because they were hostile to each other, but because US was the big market, it was the hyperpower, it was the country that gave every impression of being successful. Instead, what they've achieved is, as I said, they've pushed the Chinese and the Russians, or rather the Russians and the Chinese together, and they've created this gigantic Eurasian complex, economic, political, military, in its place. I mean, it's almost the textbook of how not to do geopolitics.
Yeah, geopolitics, diplomacy. I remember that's a great point, Alexander. I remember Putin constantly would say, I want better relations with the U.S. You know, the U.S. are our friends, they're our natural ally. Constantly he would say this. And every time he would say this, Obama would just ridicule him, mock him, put him down every single time.
It's actually very interesting to see if you go back in time and look at the film of the two men together, Putin and Obama, and the condescension with which Obama treats Putin is actually extraordinary to see. I mean, Obama, I should say, was terrible at interpersonal diplomacy. He was always gave the appearance of being bored with people, and always it gave the impression also that he always thought that he was the cleverest man in the room. So he was always bad at this, but with Putin especially, he was terrible at it. And there's a story which is, by the way, almost certainly true, because the source for it was Russia's deputy prime minister who, at that time, who was a man called Shuvalov, about how in 2011, Joe Biden, remember him, the vice president of the United States, came along to Moscow. And this is in the run-up to the Russian presidential election of that year, which started that year. And Biden, apparently on Obama's instructions, told Putin, do not stand as president of Russia. You know, this is the vice president of the United States telling a prominent Russian prime minister, a politician, Putin was prime minister of Russia at the time, you know, whether he should run in for Russia or president of Russia or not. So Putin said to him, you know, go, you know, nonsense, you know, we will decide in Russia who our president is going to be. And supposedly, in fact, not supposedly, I mean, undoubtedly, Biden then said to Putin, you know, you're overestimating Russia. It's not strong enough to stand up to the United States in the way that you think. And Putin replied, and that Russia is not as strong as the United States, but Russia has the strength to decide who the next world leader will be.
Prophetic words.
Prophetic words. It's strong enough to determine the balance of power.
All right. Alexander Mercuris, editor-in-chief of the Duran. We'll leave it at that. A good 35, 30, 37-minute discussion on a fascinating topic. So guys, hit that like, subscribe to the channel if you're not subscribed. Support the channel via PayPal, Patreon, Substar. Check us out on iTunes, SoundCloud, Telegram, where we post everything that goes on in this channel. Find us on BitChute. Find us on Duran Video, which is our own video platform. And of course, DRN20, 20% off all merchandise at the Duran shop. Alexander, a few words about our awesome shop and our awesome deal going on.
Indeed, sir. I'm an awesome shop in every respect. I mean, we were talking about Russia. Well, here we go. This is one of my favorite Duran Magic mugs. And there you see the emblem of the Russian Federation. Alex has got it also. The point is that you'll find exactly the same emblem on Vladimir Putin's mugs. So when he meets Xi Jinping and hosts him in the Kremlin, as he frequently does, by the way, this is what he's drinking from. And in fact, he drank from a mug fairly like this, not as good as this, nowhere near as good as this, actually, because our Duran mugs are the best, but with this emblem at the G20 summit just a few months ago. And it attracted quite a lot of attention. So if you want to have a mug with the same emblem as those of on Putin's mugs, here it is. But in fact, as I said, it's a much better mug. It's 15 ounce capacity. It's marvelous porcelain, beautiful porcelain. It's incredibly, it's very strong. I mean, this isn't going to splinter or crack or chip or do any of those terrible things. It keeps your tea. I drink tea from my mugs. I've been drinking, by the way, Russian caravan tea today. just so that people know, they always want to know what tea I'm drinking. But as it keeps your tea warm, it keeps your coffee warm, it keeps your hot chocolate warm, it keeps your beer cold if that's what you prefer. But you can drink anything you like from these mugs, and they are fantastic. And we have many like them. You've got, here's another mug, for example, with the emblem of Russia's Alpha Force on it. That is equivalent of the British SAS or the US Delta Force. And we've got lots of mugs like that. We've also got phenomenal shirts, like the amazing polo shirt that I'm wearing, 100% cotton, incredibly elegant and stylish, as you can see, incredibly comfortable to wear because it's so well made, and it keeps its shape beautifully. And you can see here it's got the Duran double-headed eagle, which looks to the east and the west, as we've done on this program, embroidered on it. But we've also got, as well as these great polo shirts, we've got marvelous t-shirts, we've got long sleeve t-shirts, we've got short sleeve t-shirts, we've got v-neck shirts, we've also got hoodies, we've got hats, we've got stickers, we've got amazing things in our shop. And Alex was right to remind me, we've got all sorts of extraordinary discounts you can find. Alex will tell you all about how you can get those discounts. And you can also find us on our various platforms. We've now, Alex told you about all our new platforms, which you're very excited about because they're extending the reach of our programs in ways that we think will hugely improve the outreach of our service. But you can find all that there. So get yourself the discounts, go to our shop. This is the time to buy these things. After all, it's Christmas is coming, so you can get them for yourself. You can get them for your friends as Christmas presents. You're supporting the Duran and all the work we're doing by going there. So Alex will tell you how to do all these things, how to go to our shop, how to get the discounts. Over to you, Alex.
All right, DRN20, you'll find the code in the description box down below. Just put it in at checkout. Alexander Mercurius, editor-in-chief of the Duran. Thank you very much. Till next time, everybody. Take care.